Queen Elizabeth will celebrate 60 years on the throne next month. Only one other British ruler, Queen Victoria, has observed a Diamond Jubilee. Sally Bedell Smith's latest biography chronicles the life of Elizabeth II, her legacy, and what the future holds for the British monarchy. The book is titled Elizabeth the Queen. Sally Bedell Smith joins me in the studio. Good morning to you, Sally. It's good to see you.
Good morning, Diane. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Sally, why do you think it is, or do you think it is, that Americans care deeply about the monarchy?
Well, there's probably something vestigial since long ago. We were a colony. And I think that we love the tradition and the pomp and the ritual. And all you have to do is stand in front of Buckingham Palace at 11 o'clock in the morning and see the people lined up, not only from all over, from the United States, but from all over the world. But more than that, I think that people really have so much respect for her, for the way she has conducted herself now, marking 60 years on the throne, which is quite remarkable, only the second time in 1,000 years. And she has been more than a figurehead, but she has been a symbol of the values, I suppose, that we all wish we could live. Mm. And she has conducted herself admirably through her influence, which is often unseen in dealing with her prime ministers and other high officials in British government. She has also lived an extraordinary life of service. So she's set an example, and she has rewarded service. Over the 60 years, she's given over 400,000 honors to people for exemplary service, civilians and military, and she's done that more than 600 times. She's exceedingly hardworking, and she has rarely put a foot wrong.
You know, just by coincidence, over the weekend, I watched the King's speech
Yes.
for the third time.
I'm not surprised.
Of course, these darling young girls, Margaret and her older sister, Elizabeth, are portrayed as just absolutely angelic. But young Elizabeth never thought she was going to be queen. How come?
Well, I think it was a possibility. It was a remote possibility for a while. Her grandfather, King George V, died, was succeeded by the queen's uncle, who became King Edward VIII. He was unmarried at the time, had no children, so by definition, she was next in line to the throne because she was the daughter of his younger brother. But it wasn't until he abdicated to marry Wallace Warfield Simpson, the twice-divorced American, that her father became king. And at age 10, she became heiress presumptive. They always called her heiress presumptive because she wasn't the heir apparent, because there was always the possibility that her parents could have a son. In fact, they couldn't because her mother had had two cesarean sections and it was unwise at that time to have a third. So she was the one. And the news was brought by a footman, and her younger sister, Margaret Rose, said, "Does that mean you're going to be queen someday?" And little Princess Lilibet said, "Yes, it does." And Margaret Rose said, "Poor you."
Poor you. And of course, George VI died at 56.
Yes, he did. And she did not expect to become queen at age 25. But that being said, she was very well prepared in a way he had not been. When he became king, he cried to his mother and said, "You know, I haven't been prepared for this. I've only been trained to be a naval officer."
And as you said, she took the throne at 25. Here is a speech she made at age 21.
"I declare before you all that my whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service and the service of our great imperial family to which we all belong. But I shall not have the strength to carry out this resolution alone unless you join in it with me, as I now invite you to do. I know that your support will be unfailingly given. God help me to make good my vow, and God bless all of you who are willing to share in it.
She really sounds extraordinary at 21.
She was. That was a speech that, like many other speeches, was written for her. But when she read it for the first time, she cried. And when people around the world heard her say those words, there were a lot of tears that flowed. Even her quite redoubtable and austere and stoic grandmother, Queen Mary, cried when she heard that. It just gave me goosebumps, to tell you the truth, when I heard it. And it was so sincere. I mean, one of the things about her is she never says anything she doesn't mean. And she meant every single word of that. And it holds up, obviously, with the exception of the imperial part. But she has reiterated that this is a job for life. She said that over and over again. She took a vow when she went through her coronation on June 2nd, 1953. She was anointed with holy oil. She became really chosen by God to represent her people. And it's something that is deeply embedded in her. She takes it extremely seriously one of her archbishops of Canterbury, George Carey, came to her in 2003 and said he was about to retire. And she said, you know, I can't ever do that. I'm going to carry on till the end.
Quite a statement. Sally Bedell Smith is with me. We are talking about her brand new biography titled Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. You and I both had the honor, you of meeting her, I of having her walk 3 inches away from me at the British Embassy.
Right, I remember it well. I remember seeing you in a big hat and a cast on one of your ankles that
exactly,
you had broken.
Exactly. But you and your husband actually had a conversation with her.
We did, and it was an eye-opener for me, I have to say. My husband, who agreed to allow me to tell this story, because he's somewhat of a comic foil here, but one is not supposed to ask the Queen a question, much less to ask her whether she bets at the racetrack. And he committed 2 protocol infractions simultaneously when he said, Your Majesty, did you put a wager on street sense at the Kentucky Derby, which had been the winner, and she had just been there last weekend, and she absolutely, you know, definitely.
She ignored him.
She ignored the question. But what was interesting, there was something about the way he asked the question, and he in fact knows a lot about horse racing. He can read a race, and we're watching it on television. I can't figure out what's going on. He said, "Well, you see that one and that one and that one," and she does that, and she. She sort of twigged on to that. It was a very fast reaction on her part. And the two of them replayed the entire race, which was incredibly dramatic. Street Sense went from 19th to 1st. And what I saw was this animation in her, the sparkling eyes, the gestures, the big smile. And she said, I was so surprised. There was mud all over the winner. And, of course, in the U.K., all their races are run on grass, so she'd never seen that before, and so they had this incredibly, you know, it probably only lasted about 30 seconds, but it was the liveliest conversation, and it sort of assaulted all my preconceptions about this austere, regal, slow walking woman with her handbag on her arm, and I thought, wow, there's something much more lively at work there.
And didn't the conversation turn to something else again?
Well, that was the essence of that conversation. I had a subsequent conversation with her, which was after I had been working on my biography of her for about a year, and I was invited to a reception at St. James's Palace in London for the Pilgrims, which is an Anglo-American fellowship society. And I was among a group of people who were chosen to be introduced to her. And we shook hands, and I said it was good to see her again in a sort of Anglo-American setting, as I had before at the embassy. And she said, oh, is that what brought you to London? And I said, well, actually not. My daughter is getting married here in London in a few weeks. And she said, oh, when's the wedding? And I said, the 4th of July.
Would you like to come?
And she, no, I didn't. Well, not so presumptuous. I said, oh, it's the 4th of July. And she looked at me and she got that little twinkle again. She said, that's a bit dangerous. And so, but that, you know, again, was a little sparkle of liveliness.
Right.
That, and wit. You know, she has a very dry wit.
But here's the question. Did you decide to write this biography on the basis of that first meeting?
I didn't. I was involved in doing some other work at the time, and it wasn't until 9 months later that that the president of Random House invited me to breakfast, and we were talking about possible ideas, and she said, what about the Queen? And it took me about a second to say, why wasn't I smart enough to think about that?
Sally Bedell Smith, and she did think long and hard on her new book, Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch. Do join us. I look forward to hearing from you.
More Diane Rehm is coming up here on WAMU 88.5. Hope you're enjoying this rather cloudy afternoon. I'm Elliot Francis. It's 219.
Your membership dollars help support the insightful, engaging, and entertaining programs you care about on WAMU 88.5. Become a member now at 800-248-8850 or at WAMU.org. Thanks. This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any phone calls.
One of the issues we've already talked about, and which Elizabeth herself at one point refers to, is how little training she really had for the monarchy, Sally.
Well, she was trained certainly in a far better way than her father had been. Once she became heiress presumptive at age 10, she'd been tutored by various governesses who taught her, you know, English and French and other music and things like that. But once she actually was next in line, she went through a pretty rigorous 6 years of tutoring with Sir Henry Martin, who was at Eton College, right down the road from Windsor Castle, and he took her through quite a rigorous curriculum of learning about history and the British Constitution, which is a quite complicated thing to understand. And there are volumes of these textbooks that she was given, and you can see all of her notes in the margins and things that she underlined that she felt would be important in becoming a constitutional monarch. The whole notion that that her role is to be consulted and to encourage and to warn, and that's she has stuck pretty strictly to that directive in dealing with all of her government ministers.
And here's what she had to say about it herself at age 25.
In a way, I didn't have an apprenticeship. My father died much too young, and so it was all a very sudden kind of taking on and making the best job you can. It's a question of maturing into something that one's got used to doing and accepting the fact that here you are and it's your fate, because I think continuity is very important. It is a job for life.
How old was she?
That was in 1992 when she was celebrating her 40th year on the throne. And what is also reflected in that is her, it's not really fatalism, but a couple of people talked to me about her ability to deal with anything that comes her way, anything that's thrown her way. She has an incredible serenity about her, and it's rooted partly in experience and partly in her religious faith. And I think she understood this was her destiny, and she was going to carry out her duties as best she could and work as hard as she could, and she has.
She also had a strong will as far as Philip was concerned.
Well, yes, she fell in love with him when she was 13 years old and he was 18, and on the first day they spent together at the Dartmouth Naval College.
Was this planned?
Well, it was a little bit engineered by his uncle, Lord Louis Mountbatten, who was very keen to get them together, but it was not planned on her part. He was dashing. I mean, if you look at photographs of him, he was like a Nordic god. He was really, and he was at age 18. He was very much a man of the world. He was a naval cadet at that time. He'd led a very kind of rootless life in Europe because the Greek royal family that he came from had been kicked out, and he had lived in Paris and gone to school.
He didn't have any money.
He was penniless, basically. But she fell in love with him, and they kind of got to know each other over the years. But it was a real love match, and it turns out they were very well suited to each other. They were both committed to service, and he has said, I think on the occasion of their 50th wedding anniversary, they've now been married 64 years, he said that supporting her has been the most important thing he's done in his life.
Interesting that her parents were against the match.
Well, they were. Her mother wanted her to marry, wanted the queen, then princess, to marry kind of an English, Scottish aristocrat, sort of like the queen mother's own family, the Strathmores. The Queen and Prince Philip are third cousins. They share the same great-great-grandparents,
Victoria.
Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. So he was, in a sense, more royal in many ways than she was. But they felt there were a lot of people around the then king and queen who were suspicious of him. He wasn't... He was cut from a different cloth. He had independent ideas. The courtiers in Buckingham Palace thought that he might be too much of a force for changing things, which it turned out he was in a good way. Well, just seeing things, he was very keen on getting the queen to adapt to television, for example. When she came to Canada in the United States for the first time in it was her second time in the United States, but it was her first big state visit here. She did a television broadcast in Canada, a live television broadcast to the Canadian people. Then she broadcast her opening of the Canadian Parliament. And Prince Philip was very much an advocate of that. And the following December, she did her first Christmas broadcast on television, which is another one of those moments that you go back and look at again, and it's very moving. He taught her how to use a teleprompter, so he was an early adapter in a lot of ways. He was an early adapter to emails and computers. He was big on science and technology. He once said he was the first person to pat a microchip on the head.
Two things, though. He did give up smoking.
He
for
did.
Her. And she refused to take the name of Mountbatten.
She did. And that was a source of contention right after she became queen. Churchill was very much for keeping the name Windsor. He was more than somewhat. He was even antagonistic toward Mountbatten, who presided over the transition of India from a colony to a republic. And even Mountbatten's daughter told me that they all suspected Mountbatten of being slightly pink. So, being too liberal. And the Queen out of loyalty to her father and her grandfather, who used the name Windsor, wanted to keep it. But Philip was very upset. Even though Mountbatten, ironically enough, was his mother's name, he didn't really have a surname as Prince Philip of Greece. But he said he felt like an amoeba. He was the only man who could not give his name to his children. That took, 10 years later, before the birth of their third child, Prince Andrew, she did get her prime minister, Harold Macmillan, and other government ministers to work out a compromise so that the House of Windsor would be still the family name, but all subsequent, everybody who was not a member of the royal family, subsequent children and grandchildren, would be called Mountbatten Windsor. So that mollified him in the end.
Interesting. I was fascinated with Paul McCartney's comment about her.
I had a brief interview with him. He told me some very funny stories, but he said, we were talking about her as a young woman. He said, I grew up thinking she was an absolute babe.
He
said she was beautiful and she was gorgeous. He told me about the first time that the Beatles met the Queen and Prince Philip. It was after some royal variety performance, and they were in a receiving line and they were talking, and the Queen said, "Well, where are you having your next concert?" And he said, "Slough, ma'am." And she said, "Oh, that's near us." And of course, Slough is this little community right near Windsor Castle. But he said she said it in such an unassuming way. It was like, well, you're just right down the road from Windsor.
Exactly. She has beautiful legs.
She does. When she was a young woman, Time magazine called her a pin-up beauty. I mean, she wasn't a classic beauty, but she had beautiful skin and beautiful blue eyes. She had a gorgeous figure. Once the Queen's cousin Patricia Braeburn told me that they were the Queen and Prince Philip were spending a weekend with them, and John Braeburn said, "Gosh, Lilibet has the most beautiful skin." And Philip said, "Yes, she's like that all over." Which was a very sort of sexy thing to say, I thought.
And this photograph that you have right at the front of the book shows a very sexy woman.
Yes. There's an even sexier one, which shows her when she and Philip had become engaged, but nobody knew it. And they were keeping it a secret for a while. And she was at the wedding of her cousin Patricia Mountbatten to John Braeburn. And Philip was an usher, and she had just arrived. And they're standing at the door of the church, and she's taking off her fur wrap, and he's looking at her. And you have to look at the picture, because it's the most electric glance between the two of them. And she's sort of thrusting out her chest and looking at him, and you think, wow, they're really in love with each other.
But even at that event at the British Embassy, when she passed so close to me, her skin is still gorgeous.
It is still gorgeous, and I saw it as recently as last spring.
She's had no work done.
One of her early biographers, Elizabeth Longford, made a wonderful observation, which still holds true, that she's never really done anything to her eyebrows. She has untamed eyebrows, and it's a kind of statement of her commitment to, obviously she has to look beautiful, her hair has to look beautiful. She does her own makeup, by the way, she told Annie Leibovitz that as recently as a few years ago when Annie did some photographs of her. So she's very sort of down to earth in that way.
How many people did you interview for this book? And we should say that the Queen herself was not among them.
No, she's had a policy for 60 years that's probably been wise, which is not to give interviews. What you played before was a voiceover that she did on her own at the very end of recording that 1992 documentary. But I interviewed over 200 people. I did get the cooperation of Buckingham Palace.
Why?
And, well, I had some advocates who went, who knew me and knew my work, and said that it would be a fair book. And so they by doing that, they were able to tell people who called the palace and say, go ahead, it's all right to talk to her. And they also enabled me to see her in a lot of different settings. I traveled overseas with her to Bermuda and Trinidad. I traveled in the UK. I watched her do an investiture where she gives out these honors that I mentioned earlier. I saw her in the Garter Parade and the Westminster Abbey Maundy service, which was very moving. And a state visit, I saw her, going through all her paces with the president of Mexico. So there were a lot of things that I saw, and many people close to her who I interviewed, close friends, close family, people who'd worked with her very closely.
Sally Bedell Smith, her new biography, Elizabeth the Queen. Sally, let me remind folks that they're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. What about Ireland? Did you travel with her to Ireland?
I didn't make that trip. There were only a few British reporters who went along with her, but I followed it very closely. And as David Cameron said the other day, it was a game changer. She was always interested in the problems of Ireland, and she had a personal interest in it, a tragic personal interest, which was because in 1979, the IRA detonated a bomb that killed Louis Mountbatten and several other members of his family. An occasion that you might think would have caused bitterness. One really touching thing that I learned was that after that, she took one of Mountbatten's grandsons, who was 14 years old, had been severely injured. His twin had been killed. He had been severely injured. He came out of the hospital. She asked him to come to her Highland estate in Scotland, Balmoral. He arrived at night, and she was there to greet him. She gave him soup and sandwiches and took him to his room and started to unpack his bags. And he said it was, the most intense mothering. And she was, she was able to draw out of him that traumatic experience he hadn't been able to speak of. And I said to him, I said, wasn't she bitter after that? And he said, she experienced all the hurt and shock that you would expect, and that she also probably experienced anger and incredulity, but that she maintained a very dignified stance, and she recognized that the people of the United Kingdom and Ireland both had wounds. And not only did she say that, but she acted over the years. If you listen to some of her Christmas broadcasts, which are fascinating because they're personal, she spoke often about reconciliation. And she, behind the scenes, I talked to some of the people who were Tony Blair's advisors, who were very involved in the Good Friday Accords in 1998. And she took a very keen interest in talking to her prime ministers about the progress of peace. And so it was only fitting that she would make what was a historic visit. She was the first British monarch in 100 years to go to Ireland, and she did everything pitch perfect. She wore the right clothes. She honored the Irish who had been killed in all the decades of troubles with Britain. And In talking to people afterwards and seeing what was written at the time, they all said, she made us all feel better about ourselves. It was a remarkable trip.
She had her doubts about Tony Blair.
Well, she did. She told she's been very scrupulous over the years, I have to say, in keeping her political opinions to herself, and particularly not to say anything in public. Although a good friend of hers who visited her often in Scotland said that once he looked right after Tony Blair had taken office, and she said, I think he might be in the wrong party. Which was a little bit cheeky of her. But they had a somewhat fraught beginning, because he became prime minister in May of 1997, and 2 months later, Diana died. And that was probably that week after Diana's death was probably the worst week of the Queen's life. She was up in Balmoral trying to take care of those grandsons. She was doing that mothering and putting it before duty. And Tony Blair was trying to guide her into being more responsive to the British people and helped her a great deal. And I think that changed their relationship.
Sally Bedell Smith, her new biography is titled Elizabeth the Queen. When we come back, your calls, comments, stay with us.
Monday on the Diane Rehm Show, the outcome of the critical South Carolina primary. Then New York Times columnist Gail Collins on the shortest presidency in American history, a portrait of William Henry Harrison. Monday morning at 10, right after Morning Edition, here on WAMU 88.5 and streaming live at drshow.org.
Of all the candidates running for office this election season, don't forget
William Howard Taft.
That's right. The former president who served a century ago is back, at least in a new novel.
He's kind of this president who is seen as the buffoon. He's mostly known as the president who got stuck in the bathtub.
I'm David Greene. Jason Heller, author of Taft 2012, on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekdays from 5 to 10 a.m. on WAMU 88.5.
Let's say you're at the theater and you really don't like what you're seeing up on stage. So, you let it rip.
He had keys missing on his little keyboard thing, and he was singing Stevie Wonder. That's just something you don't do. I said, boo, man.
Is booing an act of verbal vandalism or the last true expression of democracy? I'm Stephen Dubner. Join us for the next Freakonomics Radio.
Tonight at 6 on WAMU 88.5.
This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any phone calls.
And welcome back. Sally Bedell Smith has written many biographies. Her latest is Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch. She's here in the studio with me. If you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's open the phones and go to Chiefland, Florida. Good morning, Fred.
Hi, how are you, Diane?
Fine, thanks.
Same here. I just want to put a comment forward. It's like I don't understand the fascination with the monarchy anymore. To me, it seems like it's very archaic, pompous, and it's time for it to go away. And I just was curious. I know they've done a lot of good in the past, don't get me wrong, but I wonder what percentage of the population in England would rather see the money that's spent towards the monarchy to be better used for the public use, would like to see it also go away.
Good question, Fred. What do you think, Sally?
Well, I'm afraid if you lived in Britain, you'd be in a very pretty small minority. Since they started taking polls, sort of measuring approval of the monarchy and the Queen in particular, she's had a pretty consistent 80% approval rating, which is something that an American president would die for. And I think you talk about the money, I think you have to put it in the context of what it would cost to elect a president, which would be, a substantial sum. But also, I think there's more recognition than ever of the value of having a non-political head of state who exists to unify the country. I think this is more important than ever. And people recognize that the Queen does devote herself to illuminating other people who are serving, to serve herself. And believe me, the people who have audiences with her every week recognize the value of being able to talk to somebody who has 60 years worth of insights and information, who has known every world leader, who has traveled every inch of the United Kingdom and probably knows more about the human condition based on her conversations with all the people that she's had over the years. And so people recognize what she can contribute.
To Phoenix, Arizona. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, ladies. I just wanted to say it's a remarkable book, which I was fortunate enough to get an advanced copy of, about a remarkable woman. I couldn't put it down. I raced through it. Not only about the Queen, who is a wonderful person, but also about the peripheral members of the royal family. And I wondered, out of curiosity, it was nice to see that you wrote about Princess Diana truthfully, warts and all, which is often glossed over, and I wondered if you encountered much opposition about that.
Well, I had written a book about her that was published back in 1999, and I have to say, yes, I did at that time, because I did write honestly about her, and I tried to write fairly about her. So when it came time to write about the Queen, I think there was a recognition that I had been fair to the royal family and that I had been fair to Charles. And although nobody said anything explicitly to me about that, I think that was probably a plus in my favor.
Of course, the movie The Queen portrays the Queen as somewhat cold, distant, removed, almost annoyed by Diana's death.
Well, I think that was dramatic license, and I actually had the great fortune to spend some time with Helen Mirren and talk to her about what she did with the role, and also with the screenwriter Peter Morgan. If you do read the screenplay, everybody who worked on that was a Republican. They didn't have much use for the monarchy, but by the end, Helen Mirren said, "I have become a queenist," and they all had, in a sense, because they developed so much respect for her. The movie itself is a snapshot of one of the worst weeks of the Queen's life. I mean, what I've been fortunate to do is write a panorama of her life, but and it showed her, I mean, Helen Mirren brilliantly captured some aspects of her character and personality, and even little touches like how she put on her glasses and that sturdy walk that she has. Paradoxically, the way she was in that movie was much more the way she is in public. It didn't show her sort of jolly, lively private self because she was in the middle of a terribly tragic situation. Although there was a lot of research that went into that movie, it was the scenes and much of the dialogue were the product of Peter Morgan's imagination and talent.
And the prince doesn't come off.
The prince does not come off very well, and I think it's a little unfair to him. And also Robin Janvrin, who was the deputy private secretary who was with her up in Balmoral, who was sort of portrayed as a bit of a toady. He, in fact, was one of the most astute advisors around her. And I talked to one of the one of her advisors who was working in London. And of course, the critical point came in the middle of the week when the tabloids, in particular, and the people were getting very, very angry about the fact that she was still up in Balmoral. Well, she was up in Balmoral because she wanted to take care of those grandsons, but she began to see that her behavior was damaging the monarchy, and he was the one who was in charge of trying to persuade her to come down early, to make a speech, to make some gestures of compassion that would show that she cared. And Malcolm Ross, who was working at Buckingham Palace to help organize everything, said that the way Janvrin described it to him was that she was sort of metaphorically scratching his face, and that metaphorically blood was pouring down his face because she was so resistant. She had a tradition. The tradition went back centuries, which is there's a flagpole on top of Buckingham Palace that always flies the royal standard. It never flies at half mast. When the king or the queen dies, it comes down and the new royal standard comes up. So there's no such thing as half mast. So she had to come around to the whole notion of flying the Union Jack at half mast for Diana, which she did, and that satisfied her. It was a big symbol. But she also did some, you know, some terrific instinctive things, by the way. When she and Philip arrived at the gates of Buckingham Palace, they unexpectedly got out of the car. Their staff didn't know, at least the ones in Buckingham Palace didn't know they were going to do that. And she walked down and she talked to a line of mourners, a line of women. And there was a little girl who handed her a bouquet, and she said, should I put this over here? And she said, no, ma'am, that's for you. And then the speech that she gave was very, you know, it was very compassionate. It was also, if you read it and listen to it, it's totally authentic. She does not say anything she doesn't mean. And she gave Diana credit for doing a lot of good things, said there were lessons to be learned, both from the way she lived her life and her death. And it was a very effective speech. And, of course, the next thing that she did was, on the morning of Diana's funeral, instead of standing on the balcony at Buckingham Palace that she might have done in previous times, she took her family, went down to the gates, and stood there. And as the coffin went by, pulled by the horses, she bowed. And that was a very significant gesture of respect and honor.
To Hyattsville, Maryland. Good morning, Carol.
Well, good morning. My fondest memory of the Queen is from World War II, as I'm that old. And I remember the photographs of her working on a truck.
Oh, yes.
And how impressed I was that the princess was actually working on a truck. Would you please talk a bit about her service during the war?
Well, she was in Windsor Castle most of the time, but she had... What fascinated me, she had these experiences where she was put in contact with ordinary people. There was that. She had a month-long training with the ATS, where she did learn how to drive a two-ton truck, to strip down an engine, to replace a tire, to, you know, change spark plugs, all sorts of things, very practical things. She's a practical-minded person, so she enjoyed it. But also, even before that, before she moved to Windsor Castle, there were a lot of children and mothers who were sent to houses at Balmoral in anticipation of the bombing of the port. So they were sent from Glasgow, and so she was called upon by her governess to entertain all these people who were very, you know, sort of working class people, to serve them tea, to talk to them, to comfort them. And then when she moved to Windsor Castle, she was in a little girl guides group, which was like a Girl Scout group. And the same kind of thing happened when the East End of London was bombed. A whole bunch of young Cockney girls were sent to live in various houses at Windsor, on the Windsor Castle estate. And they joined her girl guides group, and they were very cheeky. Nobody was allowed to call her Lilibet except her family, not even her close friends. And they all called her Lilibet. They made her wash dishes in soapy water. They made her clean up after fires, you know, after their campfires. So, you know, she had these experiences. She had so many experiences in World War II that were atypical. You know, everybody thinks that she was kind of living in Windsor Castle and she was separate from everybody else, but she became a commander in the Grenadier Guards, and she got to know a lot of servicemen, by the way, who came through, and they would come to dinner, Americans and obviously British and from other countries, and some of them died. And she wrote very poignant condolence notes to their mothers after she had gotten to know them.
And we should say that her parents stayed in London.
Her parents,
during the bombing.
Yes, and I think that was a really, really significant time for her, because obviously she loved and admired her parents, but she saw their selfless service in a very dramatic way. Mm-hmm. They all, for the most part, slept in Windsor Castle, which was very well fortified. But every day her parents went into London and worked out of Buckingham Palace, or they would take the train around the country and buck people up. They went to the East End after it had been bombed. Buckingham Palace was bombed 9 times, and there was one moment when they could well have been killed. A bomb came that close. So they were very brave.
Sally Bedell Smith, her new book, Elizabeth the Queen. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Sarah in Utah writes, I've read that Queen Elizabeth keeps a journal. I would love to read it, she says. Imagine the history she's witnessed.
She has kept a journal since she was a very little girl. Her mother encouraged her to do so. It is obviously very tightly held.
Yeah.
She once said, Queen Victoria, of course, kept quite a copious journal. The Queen was asked about it once, and she said, well, you know, it's something I do every night. It's like brushing my teeth. And I talked to many people. I said, well, what do you think is in it? You know, and they said, well, because she does have strong opinions, she's a very astute observer. So the best guess is that those kinds of observations, she loves to kind of talk to her prime ministers about the foibles and the habits of other leaders around the world. And I've seen a couple of things she's written, very perceptive things. In one case, assessing Kenneth Kaunda, an African leader. And so I would fully expect the journals to have those kinds of perceptive assessments without violating confidentiality. She's very, very vigilant about that. Those audiences that she has with her prime ministers and with judges and with members of the clergy and military, you know, officers, generals, are nobody else is in the room. And she thinks that the confidentiality in those meetings is very important for her to get information, unvarnished information, and for them to talk openly to somebody. It's almost like a confessional.
Though she has maintained this dignity, this absolutely praiseworthy stance, her children haven't fared as well.
They haven't. And I suppose the one failing, you could say, is that she has been a somewhat detached mother. It's partly a result of her reserved nature. She doesn't like to get into confrontations. But I also think that she came to the throne when she was 25 years old. She had a 3-year-old and an 18-month-old. And she needed to prove her worthiness as sovereigns, and she's a very hard worker. And as a consequence, she was working a lot when she might well have been spending time with her children.
And here's a final email. There's always been talk Elizabeth would eventually abdicate the throne to Charles or William. How likely do you think that is?
Highly unlikely. As you heard in the clips earlier, she vowed that her life, whether it be long or short, would be dedicated to the service of her people. She said it's a job for life. She said, I can't do that. I'm going to carry on to the end. And it is because she really genuinely believes that. And there is a line of succession set up. Charles is next in line. William is following him. David Cameron called William and Kate the team of the future, and she has taken a very strong hand. I mean, she may have been a little distant from her children, but she's really been involved in William's upbringing.
Sally Bedell Smith, her new biography, titled Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch. The Life of a Modern Monarch. Congratulations.
Thank you, Diane. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Hi there, I'm Rebecca Shear, host of WAMU 88.5's Metro Connection, and welcome to Door to Door, our weekly trip around the region. Today, we visit Elk Ridge, Maryland, and Hillbrook in Northeast D.C.
My name is Dennis Chestnut. I'm a lifetime resident of Washington, D.C., and a lifelong resident of Ward 7 here east of the river. I've been living here now 63 years. I'm living now in the same home that I grew up in. The area where Hillbrook is located was referred to as Central Northeast. We called Hillbrook all kind of things in our years growing up over here in the neighborhood. It just was not really identifiable. To the west, you have 295, Nanny Helen Burroughs Avenue on the north, 47th Street on the east, and Benning Road on the south. It's always been a very vibrant commercial corridor. It was even more vibrant when I was younger. There's so much green space and parkland in this area because of the Civil War defenses of Washington. And this eastern area was very important because of the river. I believe this is one of the best kept secrets in D.C. I'm glad I stayed and excited about what I see happening and forward to, you know, some of the development that's underway, seeing it completed.
My name is Daniel Wecker. I'm the executive chef and owner of the Elk Ridge Furnace Inn, and I live in Elk Ridge, Maryland. I'm 53 years old. Elk Ridge is located midway between Baltimore and Washington. The name Elk Ridge comes from the early colonists being here. This area used to be covered with herds of elk. Elk Ridge Landing was the largest seaport north of Annapolis in colonial times, and the ships used to come here from Great Britain. And on the north side of the river, the ships used to come here to get hogsheads of tobacco down Rolling Road, which ended here in Elk Ridge. We have a lot of wild areas, and we have a lot of wildlife, and it's absolutely marvelous to go out behind my business here and see